Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. The Royal National Lifeboat Institution has been saving lives at sea since it started 200 years ago. It is a non-governmental authority. It receives no public money at all. It is funded by donations from the likes of me and you. And this month, it's celebrating its bicentenary. It's 200 years old. It's one of the oldest continually operating institutions on the planet, which still exists in its original form. It's older than the republics of China, Germany, and France. It's done pretty well. And joining me on the podcast is Hayley Whiting. She's the Heritage Archive and Research Manager for the RNLI. And she's joining me for this special bicentennial commemoration. We're going to be talking about its beginnings, and we're going to be talking about how men and women have taken to the sea in the most appalling conditions that nature can throw at us to risk their own lives to save the lives of their fellow mariners. It's an incredibly inspiring story. It's an example of something that is good in the world. If you want to donate to the RNLI after listening to this episode, you can do so. We've included a link in the show notes, so please go and do that. But in the meantime, here's Hayley and I talking about the history of this remarkable institution. Enjoy.
T-10. The atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima.
God save the king.
No black-white unity till there is first some black unity. Never to go to war with one another again.
And liftoff. And the shuttle has cleared the tower.
Hayley, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
You're very welcome.
Have there always been lifeboats? Did the communities of people by the sea sort of row out, swim out and help rescue people when they crash into the sandbar and they're hopping overboard?
Yeah, I think there's always been people who've been willing to put their lives at risk to save others at sea. But I think the sort of idea of a lifeboat is a bit more of a modern thing. So I think the earliest lifeboat, or the inventor of lifeboats, is given as Lionel Lukin, who in 1785 invented the unemergible boat. So he was a coach builder and he had an idea to see if he could make a boat that wouldn't sink, that would turn back over. I always say that the RNLI didn't invent lifeboats and we didn't invent lifeboat stations. These things both existed before we did. And Lionel is really that first person to have that idea of a more purpose-built lifeboat.
How cool. I had no idea. Because when I was a kid, that's all we talked about with lifeboats is when they capsize, they can turn themselves back over again. And that seemed to be the kind of absolutely mind-blowing technology. But that's actually from the 18th century.
That's right. So often people think that's a more modern invention, that the RNLI started doing that with its lifeboats in the 1950s, 1960s. But the earliest lifeboats we had in the 1820s could self-right.
And so why did Lionel Lukin do this? I mean, obviously, we live on an island here in the UK. No one's more than 70 miles away from the sea. The sea carried all our trade and food and commerce. And so we were a maritime nation. Presumably, it was talked about. People wanted to find ways of losing less of our fellow mariners and passengers at sea.
Yes, definitely. I mean, in the 1820s, when the RNLI was formed, there was something like 1,800 shipwrecks a year. So I think people would have realised just how dangerous the sea was. And people like Lionel Lukin were looking at that problem and seeing if they could find a solution. And he was followed by a man called Henry Greathead, and he built what people think is the first purpose-built lifeboat, so actually to rescue people. So Lionel Lukin was looking at the design of a boat and making it self-righting, but Greathead was looking at it as actually for the purposes of saving lives at sea.
So he built a sort of like George Stephenson with the railways, he didn't just build the boat, he actually kind of built the system around it and the shore facilities, all that kind of stuff.
He didn't really invent the lifeboat station. So there were lifeboat stations from the 1770s, but he was really looking at that problem of a boat that could be used by those services to save lives. So that would be self-righting. And it was called the original. And that was the design that a lot of early RNLI lifeboat stations were using.
The OG. See, kids these days, they think they came up with everything. And here we are, 1790. They invented the OG lifeboat. I love that.
That's right.
That's in South Shields, right? So that is on a very difficult stretch of coast for mariners off the northeast of England.
Yes, that's right. It is a really dangerous part of the coast. And in the 1790s, we'd have seen a high level of shipping as well.
So what about the RNLI itself? How does this lead to a sort of national institution?
Yeah, so like I said, lifeboat stations have been around since the 1770s, but they were locally run and they were quite sporadic. So there would be lifeboat stations in some communities and then there would be none in others. And really the founder of the RNLI is a man called Sir William Hillary, and he was living on Douglas on the Isle of Man. And he was actually actively involved in rescues himself. So he had been a witness and actually gone out and helped rescue people in the 1820s. And he was really moved by a few things when he was doing this. So firstly, he knew how incredibly dangerous it was for lifeboats to go out and rescue people. He knew how important it was that there was a rescue service on the coast to meet them. So what he really thought about was creating a national service. So what he was doing was really nationalizing the idea of the lifeboat, so that wherever you were and whoever you were off the coast of the UK and Ireland, there would be a lifeboat service to rescue you.
That's a big undertaking, isn't it? I mean, how did you go about doing that?
So William Hillary is quite a force. He's quite an imaginative man. He was also quite a well-connected person. So what he did in 1823 was write a small pamphlet called The Appeal to the Nation. And we have a copy of that in the RNLI archives. And in that, he sets out what he wants this organisation to be. So he's saying about the nationalisation of it, that there's this national service, but he wants there to be medals for those who have been brave and rescue people. He wants there to be payments for widows and dependents if the worst should happen to the crew, because it was incredibly dangerous. He wrote this appeal and he sent it out to the great and the good, to whoever he could think of. And he also sent it out to the British Navy to try and get them to take it on.
And I should ask, you mentioned medals, because previously these people rowing out to save shipwrecks, are these astonishingly brave and altruistic? Or did you potentially stand to gain anything from salvage? Or do people pay you to rewards for rescuing them? What was the motivation for these early lifeboat people?
Yeah, I think you're right. There's multiple motivations. Firstly, I think it is that saving lives and going out and rescuing people. People would have witnessed shipwrecks. They also would have been involved themselves, perhaps in shipping. And a lot of early lifeboat crew in particular were fishermen. So they would have known just how dangerous their part of the coast was. There was salvage. The RNLI did do that in its early period. But the appeal that Hillary sets out, he makes it very clear that that is not the primary function of this new organisation, that really the key tenant of the charity would be to save lives at sea.
I guess if you did dwell on the coast, you knew that it was worth going out and rescuing someone, because next time it might be you.
Exactly.
Britain has the world's biggest navy at the time. I've always been sort of curious about this. You mentioned he approached the navy. The navy just didn't pick it up. They weren't interested.
No, they didn't seem willing to take on this idea, whether they weren't sure that it was possible. So he decided to change tack. And like I said, he was quite well connected. And he went for more politicians, people involved in the shipping industry, people in business who he thought this would appeal to. And there were a number of politicians, particularly, who took on this idea. And they were the people who were able to kind of get his idea off the ground.
And so from its beginnings, is not a naval thing. It isn't then a government thing either. So you say politicians, they helped him build an institution that was separate from the state.
Yes, the RNLI has always been an independent charity and remains to this day. So I think those early founders were moved from a kind of philanthropic point of view, that they could see how important this organisation was. They could see that the government weren't able or willing to take it on themselves. So they helped Sir William Hillary to get enough backing and enough people involved to get the movement off the ground.
And initially, was it about sort of standardised? Did people willingly submit? Were they sort of, we'll subsume ourselves within this new body, or were there sort of a few different independent lifeboat setups?
Yes, there were independent lifeboats. So when the RNLI was founded in 1824, what it started to do was supply lifeboats to existing lifeboat stations, independent stations. There were already lifeboat stations in existence, and what the charity started to do was establish its own stations, but also supply lifeboats to those independently run stations. And really, the RNLI and these independent stations ran side by side. And it really wasn't until the 1850s that the RNLI had a kind of boom period, expanded much more. And that's where a lot of our current lifeboat stations were either taken over or established by the RNLI in that period.
And is that also when Queen Victoria granted them the royal prefix, the R?
She did grant us a royal charter, but we've always had royal in our title. Our first patron was George IV. I mentioned that Sir William Henry was quite well connected. So in his earlier career, he travelled the world with Prince Augustus Frederick, who was one of George III's younger sons. So he had that royal connection. And so we've always had the reigning monarch as our patron up until Queen Elizabeth II.
So straight away, after it's established, quite early in the 19th century, the RNLI, it takes its place really at the heart of British affections, doesn't it? And is that because of some of these rescues and a media, the press that wants to talk about them and disseminate stories about the RNLI?
Yeah, I think people could see how important it was. And there are real feats of bravery right from the very beginning. Hillary was really keen on introducing medals, and the first medal was awarded a couple of months after we were founded in 1824. Sir William Hillary himself received 4 gold medals, 3 for rescues and 1 for founding the institution. But yeah, I think in the public imagination, these feats of bravery, these volunteers that are going out to save lives at sea is really appealing.
And tell me about one of the most famous ones of all time, one right at the beginning. Tell me about Grace Darling.
Yeah, so Grace Darling, she was the first female to ever receive a gallantry medal from the RNLI. And she's really interesting because actually she's a lighthouse keeper's daughter. She was born in 1815, and in September 1838, she's in the lighthouse with her father. She wakes up in the middle of the night. She looks out to sea, and she can see on some rocks about a mile away that there are some people clinging with a shipwreck in the background, which is the Forfarshire. And she and her father realise that the lifeboat nearby isn't going to be able to reach these people in time. So they decide to go out in their own little coble rowing boat. And they row out to these people on the rocks and rescue them, take them off and bring them back to the lighthouse. It was an incredibly brave thing to do. It must have been very difficult, stormy conditions, nighttime. And Grace really captures the Victorian imagination. She becomes this instant heroine and celebrity. And like I say, she and her father are rewarded with silver medals from the RNLI. She's also sent gifts and money from all sorts of people. The Duke of Northumberland, he basically looks after her and her family. We have a museum that's dedicated to Grace Darling in Bamborough in Northumberland, and you can see some of these gifts that she was given. So on display is her original kind of earthenware teapot that the family used in the lighthouse. And then there's the silver tea service that was given by the Duke of Northumberland in recognition of her bravery. And she really seemed to capture something in the public's imagination.
I've been to that museum. It's an extraordinary thing. You cannot emphasise enough to any landlubbers listening to this podcast just how difficult and dangerous those waters around the Farne Islands are. Was she in the RNLI at the time?
No, not at all. So the connection is that she was given a medal for her bravery. She wasn't connected to the RNLI in any other way. And we're not aware of any other rescues that she did. Very sadly, she died just a few years after the rescue in her mid-20s from what we think was TB. So no, she didn't have any of the further rescues.
She helped sort of mobilise or just focus attention on this new institution and, well, the rescuing of people from the ocean.
Definitely. I think people thought she was incredibly brave and really inspirational. And I'm sure she inspired others and, yeah, certainly helped to raise attention for the lifeboat service.
You're listening to Dan Snow's History. We're talking about the RNLI. There's more coming.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I'm looking for answers to the big questions about every aspect of life in the early modern period. Like, how did the memory of Anne Boleyn continue to influence the court of her daughter, Elizabeth I? How were fairies brought to life on the Elizabethan stage? And how did the arrival of male-only doctors threaten the lives of women? In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Subscribe now and follow me on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when you're using messaging apps, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high-quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes, and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage. Add unlimited photos and videos and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's auraframes.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. Talk to me about some of the other classics that you, as an institution, remember. What about the Whitby disaster?
Yeah, well, over 200 years, we've had so many incredible feats of bravery by our crews. But the Whitby lifeboat disaster of 1861 is a really key part of our history. So Whitby, 1861, Henry Freeman is a young man on the crew, and the crew actually go out on a rescue. And it's his first ever rescue, the first time he's been out with the lifeboat. And he diligently puts on a cork life jacket. And this is a new design by an R&I inspector. So he puts it on because that's what he's told to do as a new member of the crew. The rest of the crew don't put these on. I should say that Whitby lifeboat at this point is independent of the R&I, but we had supplied them with these life jackets. And unfortunately, on this rescue, the lifeboat is capsized and all of the crew are sadly lost apart from Henry Freeman. And in the inquest after the rescue, after this disaster, they say that the reason that he'd survived was because he was wearing this new design of life jacket. And the R&I had introduced this life jacket about 6 years earlier, and the crews hadn't really been very keen to wear them. They're quite big and bulky, made of cork, quite heavy, and the crews didn't really want to wear them when they were going out on their open rowboats in these rescues. But Henry Freeman really helped to change people's perception of the life jacket and was a really important rescue.
Interesting. You can imagine all the old lags absolutely refusing to wear it and then, sadly, in their case, paying the ultimate price. We should mention that, I mean, they weren't alone in losing their lives. I mean, it's what's astonishing about the R&I is the number of their volunteers, and it remains pretty dangerous, but it was extraordinarily dangerous in the 19th century. Would they even then always go out? Was there an ethos of saying yes? Or sometimes they went, sorry, mate, it's just too bad out there tonight.
Yeah, so in the early period in particular, it was incredibly dangerous. Even launching a rowing boat out into the breaking waves to go out and rescue other people would have been phenomenally difficult. But our crews then and now, they're there to answer the call, and they would go out and save lives at sea whenever they could.
If you haven't ever done it, go online and just try and Google beach launch rowing boat in big surf, and you will see how impossible it is. The boats get tossed around like a cork. And also, they are all powered, we should say as well. So these people are rowing out. And so most of these wrecks would have been visible from the shore. So they're kind of inshore wrecks. They're wrecks on headlands, on sandbars, things like that. They didn't tend to be over the horizon, obviously, I guess.
Yeah, so in that early period, again, we wouldn't have the communications that our crews have today. The only way to know that a wreck is in trouble was either from them letting off a rocket so that you could see it from the shore, or people just being able to see the ship on the horizon. So yes, they wouldn't have been too far out.
Tell me about a couple of other rescues. I can't get enough of these that you think are worthy of, well, being remembered. I mean, they all are, of course, but I guess that either because they're so dramatic or because they change something.
Yeah, I think that's right. A lot of the rescues that we talk about in RNI history are ones that have gone on to affect a change, whether that's a technological change or a sort of safety change. So there's a couple that spring to mind. One is the 1886 disaster at Southport and St Anne's in Lancashire. And this stands as the most crew that the RNI have lost in one single rescue, where 27 lifeboat crew sadly lost their lives going out to rescue the Mexico. And one lifeboat was capsized and the other as well. And there were only two survivors from those two lifeboats. So it's an incredibly sad event, an incredibly difficult thing for that community. Most of the crews were related to each other, fathers, sons, uncles, brothers. But we talk about that disaster not only because it's the most lives that we've lost, but because it led to a really important change in fundraising for the RNI. So there was a man called Charles McCara who was involved with the St Anne's lifeboat, and he was instrumental in raising funds for the widows and dependents of those who were lost in that disaster. And he took a little look at the RNI's finances at the time as well. And he saw that the RNI would get a boost in income when we had a really brave rescue, where perhaps medals were awarded, or perhaps a bump in income when we had a sad loss of crew. People wanted to support the lifeboat to make sure that we were providing the best kit possible. And he thought really that it was crazy to wait for either of those things to happen, that there should be a regular stream of income so that the RNI could run properly. So what he did was he set up something called Lifeboat Saturday, and this was a fundraising event in Manchester. And I think that's another reason we love this story, is because you might expect it to be held by the sea, where people might actually be near a lifeboat. But he held this in Manchester, and it was the world's first charity street collection. So the first time that people had kind of gone out onto the streets and organised an event in this way. It was hugely successful. He arranged for lifeboats to be pulled through the streets of Manchester. There was music and dancing and parades. And the lifeboats actually launched onto a lake in Manchester so people could see what a lifeboat looked like on the water. And really, that was the birth of this type of fundraising for the RNI and for other charities too. So yeah, it's a really key part of our history.
Extraordinary. And people living abroad will be surprised to learn that the lifeboat is sort of one of the most recognisable charities and causes in the UK, even in places quite far from the sea. It's kind of ubiquitous. And that's obviously a tribute to your institution's marketing and fundraising and everything as well. But it's always been quite close to the centre of our national life.
Yes, definitely. And I think it's a tribute to the inland volunteers as well, all the branches that raise funds for the RNI, no matter where they are, whether they're near the coast or not. And although lifeboats are mainly on the coast, although we have lifeboats inland, say London on the Thames as well, a lot of the people that are rescued are not people from the coast who may find themselves in difficulty in the water, maybe never even expecting to be in the water at all. And also now with lifeguards for the RNI as well, that a lot of the people that are using the water are actually from inland themselves.
That's true. During lockdown, we had a lot of paddleboarder. People bought paddleboards the first time, didn't quite understand about tides, and they went whizzing away down the river estuary, having a lovely old time, turned around, realised they couldn't get back. And me and the kids used to pluck them out of the water and take them to the beach. We had great fun. and remind us today, still astonishingly, no national funding at all for the RNLI.
No, we are an independent charity. That's right. Reliant on the funds of people who kindly donate to us.
And how many lives have you saved since 1824?
The figure is just over 144,000 lives saved, which is phenomenal and, yeah, testament to the thousands of volunteers that we've had since 1824.
And evolving times now, it's probably not the merchant marine, commercial ships. It's probably leisure craft, small boats, inshore. Presumably it's changed.
It has changed over time. And in the 1960s, the RNI introduced inshore lifeboats, which are the small inflatable boats that really could get into the shallower water where people were perhaps using the sea for more leisure activities. So yeah, the rise of the use of the beach the rise of things like paddleboards and canoes and the way that people used the water, that really changed. And that led to a kind of technological development where the RMI decided to look at a different kind of craft to be able to do that. So 1963, we introduced those inshore lifeboats. And they're really the sort of workhorse of the RMI. They do a huge amount of our rescues. But these days it's a real mix, especially depending where you are on the coast of the UK and Ireland. The water use can be quite different, but we have the craft that are available to meet the needs of the rescue.
So weirdly, slightly going back to the original model, which are smaller open boats operating fairly close inshore.
Yes, that's right, being able to get to those rescues.
Hayley Whiting, thank you very much for coming on the podcast on this, the 200th anniversary of the founding of the RNLI. Tell us, how can people support, learn more about what you do?
So I'm the archivist for the RNLI. So you can find out all about our history on the RNLI's website, rnli.org. You can also see how to support us, whether you'd like to volunteer as a fundraiser, volunteer as crew, get involved with the charity in whatever way you would like to. Check out the website.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much indeed. And congratulations for everything you and your extraordinary organisation have achieved over the last 200 years.
Thank you for having me.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History Hit. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.